You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivasa Prakash.
All right. Well, good afternoon and welcome to the latest episode of Keeping It Simple with Simplify. So today's theme is intergenerational conflict, where we're going to have a wide-ranging conversation about the different opportunities and risks that are out there for different generations of investors. And today we're absolutely delighted to have two all-star first-round draft pick Gen Zers in the form of Kyla Scanlon, who has found an amazing audience by taking complex, usually boring topics and making them interesting and digestible through her preferred mediums of TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, and then also does some really wonderful longer form with really cool visuals on Substack in the written format. And then essentially what she's done is taken something pretty boring and made it interesting and accessible for her age cohort. And then kind of even further down the age segment off of his first week of university at University of Toronto, which unfortunately was remote thanks to Mr. Trudeau. But Sri Prakash, who is the host and founder of Market Champions. For those of you who don't know Sri's story, he started this podcast when he was 14 years old. And has had some of the amazing thinkers in investing on the podcast. And then, of course, we have our regular host, Harley Bassman, aka the Convexity Maven, who may represent the boomer generation, but doesn't have to like it. We know that he looks wonderful. We know his chains are awesome. So thank you for the comments in advance. And then Mike Green, aka Professor Plum, who is literally calling in from his mom's house right now. He claims he's Generation X and has the concert t-shirts and cargo pants to prove it. But a couple of housekeeping items before we kick off. There is a Q&A button right down at the bottom of the screen. Click that. We will see it in real time. We're going to try and answer questions as we go. The chat button, if you just want to make a comment and make fun of us, you can use that as well. But Q&A is the way to go. We're going to try and answer these in real time. If there's time at the end, we'll have a devoted session for Q&A. But this conversation is meant to be fun. It's meant to be entertaining. It's meant to be informative. It is not meant to be investment advice. So please don't take it as such. So with that, we're going to start off with a poll. So Jimmy, if you would put up our first poll, we want to read the room and see, you know, what generation does everyone in here belong to? All right, looks like we're having some issues with the poll. Jimmy, do you have it? All right, there we go. All right, so for our intergenerational conflict, choose your team. What generation are you in? Do we have anyone here from the greatest generation? It'd be interesting to see. And if you are Generation Alpha, which is born after 2012, if you select that, you're going to be dumped off the call because we want people to be able to use colorful language that your parents will frown upon. So if you are Generation Alpha, good on you for being on the call, but have a great afternoon. So with that, Jimmy, will you please show us the results? All right.
Wow.
Interesting. So we've got a couple people from the silent generation, mostly dominated by boomers, Gen X, and millennials. Kyla and Sri, you guys have disappointed us greatly with your reach into Gen Z, but we still have a broad enough reach here across generations to have an interesting conversation. So with that, Mike, why don't you take it and let's discuss.
So part of the dynamic, I'm sorry, I'm just looking at the question in chat. Is Mike sitting in the house Hitchcock used to film Psycho? No, I am not sitting. I'm not sitting in the house that Hitchcock used to film Psycho, but I am truly at my mother's apartment. So this was one of these conversations that, you know, Harley and I both have this all the time. We talk all the time about what's happening to the younger generation. We have kids that are both in Generation Z and are approaching maturity and approaching the point where they're asking us, what do we do to invest? We've got this incredible opportunity with Kyla and Sri to kind of ask the question, like, how does the younger generation actually think about the world of investing? What are you looking for? What types of products are people investing in other than Bitcoin? Although obviously I want to hear about the crypto investments. And most importantly, get a sense for how you guys think about the dynamic between the generations. Because there's this, you know, this classic phrase that's emerged from, in particular, the Gen Zs, to a little bit less extent, the millennials, of the okay boomer type framework, right? So given that, I'd love to hear from you guys, what in the world are you doing on an investment podcast, and how are you thinking about your personal investments at this stage? Why don't we start with Kyla?
Yeah. So what am I doing on an investment podcast? So I was kindly invited. So thanks for having me on. I guess like for me and like most of my audience who tends to be in like that 20 to 27 ish age frame. So like a little bit like the millennial group, most of them are still trying to figure out like what investing is. Like they have a general idea of what a stock is, but they don't really know like what to build a portfolio on, like portfolio allocation. It's just something that's like a little bit not taught in school. So that's what I like make my content about. But for me personally, like I'm super into crypto. I think it's really interesting. I worry about the regulatory framework around it. I really like tech. So I'm invested in like a lot of fintech companies, and I really like waste management companies. So I like try to have a diversified portfolio where I'm like betting on the future per se. But then I also have these like recessionary companies where if things go south, like, you know, we're still going to have trash. So that's how I think about my personal portfolio design.
So you're diversifying, but you're buying individual stocks. Do you have a 401k?
I do. Yeah. But in that I'm a target date person.
A target date.
I know. Don't come for me. but I am a target date person in the 401k. And then my personal account is where I like focus my energy on, which I know is like, that's a touchy topic. So
It's actually not touchy. I mean, for me, it's actually really interesting. And I wish that we had done a poll to hit exactly the millennials and Gen Zs in the audience and ask them the question, you know, do you have a 401k? How are you investing, et cetera? Because as I've shared publicly with people, I mean, the target date fund answer to the 401k may have been the only question, the only options that were available to you unless you sought out a self-directed, right? Which is hard to do. Sri, same question to you. You know, are you betraying the principles under which I've raised you, and are you investing in passive indexes and target date funds, or what are you doing these days?
So anecdotally speaking, at least my friends as a whole, they've gotten more into stuff like number one crypto and number two trading options, and a lot of it is social platforms that. We saw the rise of meme stocks earlier this year. And with that, I also saw a rise in the number of my friends asking me, you know, what stock they should be buying. And obviously I didn't give them an answer to that, but what you see is, you know, as Kyla mentioned, you know, a lot of people have started getting more into crypto, have started getting more into options and so on. And at least personally speaking, I'm similar to Kyla in a way, because I like to pick stocks as well. And we've had this discussion before, but I'm to an extent still a value investor, still have some faith in in Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett. But at least thinking about portfolio construction, you know, I spend a lot of time, you know, reading annual reports, going through financial statements, looking at, you know, earnings transcripts, so on. I've joked around that I'm really just a boomer in a zoomer's body, but but yeah, that's
significantly better than the alternative. But it's when you think about, you know, being a value investor and you read annual reports, et cetera, do you build a DCF, discounted cash flow model?
Yes, I've betrayed you, Michael. But yes,
no, that actually is incredibly important if you're going to do a single stock. Right. When you do a discounted cash flow, where are you getting your forecast from?
So typically it comes from either my analysis or usually what I do with DCFs is, I think it was Warren Buffett who said this in the Essays of Warren Buffett. And he talked about using sort of a very, very conservative estimate for growth and a slightly higher than normal discount rate to ensure that, you know, you're sort of guaranteed getting a margin of safety, as you know, as the value investor crowd calls it. And so that's sort of what I think of when like purchasing the stocks to ensure that, you know, let's say, you know, things just go absolutely, you know, disastrous. Do I still have a margin of safety in that type of situation? And, you know, if the answer is yes, and, you know, and there's still, you know, a sort of catalyst and, you know, the base case is still higher than that, you know, that tends to usually be some sort of a worthy investment.
Now, when you think about doing something like a discounted cash flow analysis and you're using a conservative growth assumption, like how can you find something in this market that is
cheap? You don't.
You don't, right?
Yeah, so, you don't.
So there's nothing to buy when you approach it from the value investor framework.
At least at the moment, not really.
Which leaves you to buy crypto, is what you're telling me. Crypto and options. Okay. Kyla, do you model the companies that you invest in? Oh, look at that smile.
I used to. I mean, that used to be like part of my job when I was at my old company. Like I built models. But now I'm just like, do I like the company? Do I think it'll do okay in 10 years? Sure. So yeah, I've strayed from the valuation framework. I think it's like really important still, but for me, like, I just don't do it. I used to like really, really do it. Like I used to build all sorts of models, did whack, like everything, but yeah, not anymore. Yeah.
Fascinating. I mean, it could be that you guys are just that much faster than I am in the development path, right? Because I spent probably 15 years as a single stock picker trying to, you know, really understand the companies, et cetera, before I realized that, yeah, that's just not working right now. So when you think about that dynamic, when you think about, you know, what does it look like in 10 years? Is that just a function of your time horizon? So you buy them and you have no interest in trading them effectively for 10 years?
No.
Or do you actively trade?
I used to actively trade. So I traded options like all throughout college, and I just like time was not my friend, you know, over the past couple of years. So I didn't have time to trade as much as I wanted to. So I still like sell covered calls against my like core positions, but that's the only options trading that I do. So the main thing is like, I just want to have a portfolio that reflects my beliefs. And then I have some companies that I'm just like, I don't like Facebook. Like, I'm not like, oh yeah, it's like Zuckerberg's the best guy ever. Like, I don't, you know, that's not how I really feel about the company, but I do think they're going to do really well. And this is not investment advice, but I do hold them, but I'm not like their biggest fan.
So that's interesting. And now, is your interest in Facebook a function of your participation in Facebook itself, or do you have a Facebook account?
No, I haven't logged on to Facebook in like maybe 3 years. Yeah.
That's pretty much like me too. I mean, it's I always find it fascinating that people talk about how Facebook is the future, but
it's more than just, it's more than the social. It's more than the social. So like Oculus, I do think that they're going to be like first movers in sort of the metaverse space. They have WhatsApp, they have Geo, like they have a lot more stuff outside of like Facebook, the Facebook.
Interesting. Okay. Harley, when you think about your kids and their investment, where would they fit in the spectrum that we've laid out here, which is basically we like to do valuation analysis, but in the absence of the opportunity to really do it, we're just going to go buy crypto.
Well, I would say I like Kyla's pairs trade of trash currencies and trash companies. So that kind of works. My kids, they invest, but I'd say it's really, you know, longer term horizon. They'll pick a few names, but I'm sure they also own just, you know, SPY and some maybe, you know, I'd advise them to buy like, you know, a mid-dated high grade fund to diversify. But you know, other than that, I mean, I think it's very challenging to go and pick single names unless that's your profession. I mean, I rarely pick single names, and I mean, I'm kind of a professional. I think it's very challenging to do that. But I push back on Sri on one thing, that if you really go look at the SPUs, SP 500, and pull out the top seven names, really hasn't budged all that much in the last number of years. The value, you know, FANG dynamic has widened dramatically. And of course, you know, doing a PE ratio on companies with negative earnings and everything, and the way that the weightings are done make it challenging. But I think there's a lot of stuff out there that actually is a reasonable value oriented that's viable, but it's just boring. I mean, I'm not gonna mention names over here, I'll get in trouble for that. But I mean, anything in the oil sector, we're not going out of oil anytime soon, despite, you know, the politics of it. And these companies have cash flow that covers a 5-6% yield. That's a bad idea in a 0% environment? I don't think so. So, I mean, it's just the problem is the value stocks are pretty boring and no one wants to buy them.
Well, so Kylo referred to the dynamic of having a barbell portfolio with you know, Republic Services or the trash companies. I'm guessing that's what you were referring to, waste management, et cetera. When you, you know, it's an interesting observation, Harley, when you think about stripping out the top names or the most expensive or the largest names out of the S&P 500 and presenting it in that fashion, you know, while the valuation for the index itself looks relatively cheap on that framework, even the energy companies themselves are really not that cheap, right? They're it's interesting.
Are P12 bad?
For a cyclical capital intensive business.
I'm trying to call oil a cyclical, I mean, per se. But nonetheless, I mean, even for a cyclical, I mean, auto companies are cyclical, but oil companies certainly not at peak earnings right now. And you got a PE of a dozen, that's bad in a 0% world, 1% world. I mean, it really begs the question, it's three, it's like, if you do a DCF, what number do you use for your rate? I mean, that's why the FANG stocks are all trading where they are, is because they're effectively 70-year duration bonds, which is the risk of the whole world. If rates actually went up, even to where they were a year and a half ago, you probably see the FANGs get not wiped out, but, you know, worth less, not worthless, worth less. It makes a big deal when you go and take that discount rate from 2 to 3.
So thinking about what Harley is saying, and actually there's an interesting question that's been raised in the Q&A, right? Which is, how does your generation and candidly my generation and Harley to a certain extent you as well, like if we were to return, if we were actually to get higher rates, if we were to get inflation, would that change the way that you invest? Would you move away from...
Break that into two pieces, because I'm not going to stipulate that inflation and higher rates go together. I think it's two different concepts.
You absolutely schooled Bill Flugenstein and Grant Williams on exactly that topic. And I think that's actually a really important one. I always point out to people that when inflation was 4,000,000% in Zimbabwe, the interest rate was 9, right? So 9%. So there doesn't have to be a link in any way, shape, or form. But there is this interesting question, which is, if we were to get inflation, would you change the way that you invest? If you were to get higher interest rates, would it change anything in terms of what you're describing? Let's start with Kyla.
I think that's like tough because, I mean, like I've never seen high interest rates. So I think to that question, like, I don't even know what that would look like. So yeah, I would probably have to change the way that I would invest, but there would be a learning curve to that. Like I can't even like fathom, like my parents all the time, they're like, oh, you don't know what it was like. And like, we had our student loan debt was crazy. And it's just like, there's like not, you know, a former knowledge base on that. So I'd have to learn how, but yeah, I mean, I'd imagine it changes the way everybody invests. Like it would just change how companies are valued too. Like everything would have to change. I'd imagine. Right.
I think it would have a big impact. I think it's an interesting question that you actually answered in the way that I would kind of hope, which is, man, I've just never seen it before. I'd point out, by the way, that when you think about high interest rates, I mean, with the exception of a very, very, you know, brief period in the 1980s, the high interest rates were a feature. Even when I bought my first house in 1999, I paid 7 7/8 for my mortgage. Right, which roughly the same level you would have paid had you gone back to 1990 or if you'd gone to 1985. So I do think that it is kind of one of these things that it's shocking to me that you've never encountered it in any way, shape, or form. It's interesting. Would you buy bonds if you could get 8% on a 10-year?
That's the right question, Mike. It's not are the companies worth less with rates at 5 or 6, but all of a sudden, would you allocate money to bonds instead? Because right now, buying bonds is a storage facility for money. It doesn't pay any interest. Yeah.
Would you buy bonds at 5% interest, Kyla?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to have allocation to that. But like right now, it's just not appetizing. It's boring, you know, and there's just no reason to park your money there.
I loved the vocal fry. Boring. It's boring. Bonds are really? Boring. Yeah, yeah, you did it. Totally.
Did I? Oh, that's the worst. Okay. I'll have to practice not to do that.
That's my career. That's okay.
No, somebody commented that the other day and I was like, oh, no.
No, I don't do vocal fry. All right. Shri, really? Give us your best vocal fry about bonds. Tell me.
Come on, man. It's boring.
Now, if you were to, let's play this game. So 10-year moves to 5%, equities shockingly are unchanged because everyone has forgotten that as bonds, you know, rise in interest rate, that there's going to have to be far more of them issued as the federal government is paying. Therefore, if I think about a balanced fund exposure, it's going to have even more equities. So everyone's going to be really surprised that like 2000, we've got really high valuation in equities. What are you going to do at 5%, Sri? Are you going to buy equities? Are you going to buy a 10-year bond that guarantees you 5%? Are you going to buy crypto?
So what actually happened in the 1970s, and as we've discussed, is sort of the biggest driver then was demographics, and they had a lot of other things, you know, the energy crisis, food crisis, etc. But you know, what I would argue is that at least as long as inflation lasts, you know, you should sort of be, I guess, long commodities as well. And if you sort of look at the situation and you can make a case for inflation starting to decline, you know, that's sort of when you would want to go long bonds, because, mm-hmm. you know, if rates went up throughout the 1970s, then let's say, you know, buying bonds in, say, 1975 and, you know, rates rising after and yields rising after that would mean that bond prices would fall. And that wouldn't be a good investment, would it?
It's interesting, though, because, you know, Kyla's target date fund, right? So let's play that through for a second. So Kyla's target date fund would be receiving cash inflows from bonds that are now paying higher interest rates. But at the same time, the rising level of interest rates would mean that the bonds are underperforming in price terms. And perversely, her target date fund is going to be buying bonds on a continuous basis, effectively. Right. I mean, it's one of these interesting things where when we think about the dynamic of systematic investing and a balanced portfolio that is trying to maintain a fixed allocation, that's going to lead to all sorts of interesting behavior that we may have never seen before. There's an interesting question here. You brought up commodities, Sri. Kyla, have you ever bought a commodity? Not even like, you know, generic laundry detergent. I'm joking.
I bought GLD, the ETF, but I've never bought like, yeah.
So no. You have bought a commodity. You bought GLD, the ETF.
ETF, yeah.
Okay. Sri, have you ever bought a commodity?
I've attempted trading them with a decent amount of success, but it's only been a few times. So.
That was a very humble brag there. So what commodities have you traded?
So one was... buying oil when I think it was a few weeks back, you know, it just collapsed 8% on a Monday. And the very next day, there was sort of a technical signal that it would go higher. And I decided to hop on it and it did go higher and it was nice. And I've tried playing gold short before it's limited. It resulted in sort of a really limited loss, but so that's overall what I've really done in commodities. So, you know, I'm not the commodity guy. I'm not a Willem Quaker by any means. So
you're not who? I'm sorry.
I'm not a Willem Quaker. I think that was, he was a commodity legend.
Got it.
Back in the day. Yeah.
Wow. See, this is where I told you everyone I was going to get schooled. Okay. Would you maintain an allocation to commodities going forward? Do you think there's an inflationary environment or are you worried about that?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I personally don't think we're going to see inflation over, say, you know, the next few years. I'm personally in the transitory camp, and I think you know, we've sort of talked about this. I made a thread on Twitter as well, and you did a KIS on this last month. But I think that the main argument is that, you know, inflation is sort of the rate of change in prices and not the price level itself. So even if the price level remains elevated, you would have to see the fancy word here would be a continued shift to the right in aggregate demand to see, you know, prices continue to rise. And if that doesn't happen, and I, at least personally, I don't think that's going to happen, but if that doesn't happen, you know, the rate of change will start to come down, and the rate of change is what we typically call inflation. So at least personally, I wouldn't own any commodities, at least as of right now, excepting uranium. I find uranium to be interesting based on whatever research I've done. And yeah.
Oh, hold on one second.
Is your mother getting you? Oh, Mom wants them.
Yeah, no, Mom's bringing over the meatloaf.
Mike, why don't we focus on the future for a second over here? I'm curious what these two think about the path going forward. Because I would say that, you know, the boomers have been like locusts, eating everything in their path, and our politics and our economy has all been revolving around the boomer, which is effectively the pig and the python in this country. And now that we're reaching our retirement age, we've adjusted our politics to basically direct massive government support, Social Security, Medicare, at the expense of education, research, forests, ecology, all other kinds of things, you know, and the prices for what, you know, millennials or Gen Z or Gen X, whatever it is, but what they're paying have gone, housing prices have advanced much more than wages have in the last 20 years. I'm curious how you two think about the outlook going forward. Are you optimistic, pessimistic about things?
I can go first. And I actually have like a little bit of a follow-up to Sri. So like you were talking a little bit about like demand pull inflation, but there's also cost push inflation. And I think that's what I'm a little bit more worried about, especially like you're seeing it show up in semiconductors, like what's going to happen with that? And if we have a massive semiconductor shortage, which is like increasingly becoming a problem, I think that you're going to see sort of inflation across the board. And to the point of the future, like, I think there's just been a lot of like can kicking down the road, like, oh, we'll fix the climate. Like when we fix the climate, like, we'll like worry about, you know, getting people into houses when we get into houses, we'll worry about like rebuilding infrastructure when we rebuild infrastructure. So I think there's just like a lot of like project based stuff that has to be done. And the cost of that is going to be passed off to this next generation. If we can kick the can, like we probably will, because that seems to be the human thing to do. But yeah, I mean, I'm just worried in terms of like how things are evolving, just like on the climate front. Like I don't think New York is supposed to flood the way that it did. Like, I just don't think that's something that's meant to happen. I think that we can solve it, but like, we're going to have to apply technology. And I worry, like, to get back to the point I brought up first, I worry that technology will become potentially less accessible because of like all the shortages that we have and like these raw materials to, and also like labor shortages to like build out these semiconductors and to really get things rolling on that front. So that's, I'm just like a little worried. I'm not a bear. I'm not a permabear. I'm super optimistic on society, but I do have like those core things that I worry about. Yeah.
So to me, that's actually a really interesting observation. And Sri and I were talking about this. He brought up an observation from Mark Dow, who's on Twitter and is a well-known macro commentator. You know, Mark sees this, I think, very similarly to the way I do, which is supply tends to be pretty elastic, right? If you give it enough time, it tends to be pretty elastic. What causes the durable and runaway inflation is either where supply is in a position where it can't respond, right? Because France has taken over Germany's, you know, production region, industrial production region in the aftermath of World War One. Or because the population growth is so rapid associated with the baby boomers. And these are points that both Harley and I have raised from a demographic feature, you know, that it creates a continuous impulse on the demand side that the supply side never really is able to catch up to. And the 1970s had, Sri has done a lot of work with me on this, on exactly this topic. You know, the 1970s had kind of the perfect storm where you simultaneously had an explosion in aggregate demand being driven by the baby boomers coming of age, deciding that they wanted, dishwashers and microwaves and apartments and everything else. And at the exact same time, we encountered the oil shocks that effectively shut off about a third of the productive capacity of the United States, right? So that was a really, really unusual experience. The dynamic of cost push inflation that you're highlighting tends to be very temporary in nature. And I highlight that because the general narrative of the story in the 1970s is this cost push inflation. There's actually some fascinating research that was done in the late 1980s that basically says, yeah, it didn't happen. Right? That's not what actually occurred, that it was largely demand pull. I think it was Maida who was the actual academic behind it. So when you think about the narrative that you're hearing, is it the cost push? Because it doesn't feel like it's a demand pull story, or at least that's not the one that's being told.
Yeah, I think so. But like, that seems to be like what I've noticed. I think there's a lot of demand from coming out of the other side of one day COVID ending, but yep. I think that there's also like just shortages across the board.
Yeah, we definitely have seen that. Harley, when you asked the question, are you optimistic? Are you thinking about it from the standpoint of the general opportunity for this generation, or are you thinking about it from the standpoint of politics, or are you thinking about it from the standpoint of equity expectations? We were talking internally about a competitor who put out some forecasts today for long-term equity expectations, particularly in the private markets, that it's, at least it's simplified, we were opening our eyes pretty wide to in terms of the forecasts. What was the direction that you were leaning What were you focused on?
About that, you know, when I was, you know, their age, you know, you could buy muni bonds that probably yield 8%. You could go and even though my first house had a mortgage of 10.5%, I could still afford that with a, I won't call it a starter job, but yeah, kind of like an ordinary somewhat starter job. And the stock market was trading at PEs that weren't crazy. So if you went and did your job and kind of plotted along, kept your head down, you could invest and you could buy assets, real estate or cars, whatever else it might be. And you could probably, you know, survive and keep up and advance yourself. Right now, you can't buy bonds. I mean, at what, 1%, it doesn't matter if we're up or down. I mean, there's nothing there. Equities, I'd say, are interesting to the extent if you're picking a value portfolio, pays dividends. Housing is insane. I have a daughter working at Google earning a fancy salary, and it's unclear she could buy an apartment in New York. And this is kind of crazy town. And I find this whole thing, like, the boomers have basically pulled forward all the value and given the bill to the millennials and below. And Kyle, I won't put you on the spot, but a little bit. So I'll ask the question this way. Of your friends that you meet at the bar, how many of them voted in the last election? What percent?
So that's actually an interesting question. I have some, like, it barbells. So I have some friends that are, like, super politically active. And then I have some friends that are not, right? So it's those two extremes. I would probably say like 60%.
I guess the Trumpies think you voted illegally, but whatever.
Shree was able to vote in Chicago, yeah. But
if you look at the last election, let's call it the, you know, 18 to 29 year old set, 40% voted versus the millennial and older, boomer and older was 70%. And in the non-presidential 2018, 2014, you had 55% for boomers and only 20% for the lower age group. And so not only have the boomers already swept the land of all the valuable goods, but we're keeping it that way because we vote. But on the other hand, as much as you guys spend all your time tweeting and instating and everything else, which I don't believe in, why don't you get off your goddamn butts and vote? I mean, that is how you change society. And if you have 20% voting and off your election, which is where the Congress is created, not the presidency, which tends to be more important, where governors are elected, right, locally, and governors, all politics is local. I wonder, between the two of you, why don't you think your generation is voting?
I think there's like an element of past, I don't even want to say, like, I've thought about this quite a bit because it is concerning and it's like kind of like an obvious answer. I think that they're like on the more negative end of the perspective, like there tends to be sort of like this passive outlook, like we can't change anything, so why would we try? And then I think on like the more practical end, so like Kevin just dropped it in the chat, if we vote by a text message, that would change. A lot of people maybe speaking a little too broadly, but like just a generalization, a lot of people don't want to go to like a voting booth. They just don't want to go. So like, I think there's also like an element, I don't want to say that they're lazy, but like there's sort of like those barriers, that friction, and that can prevent people from doing something that doesn't. And I think there's also like issues in general with like long-term outlook with this generation. Like a lot of my friends that I talk to, and like myself included, tend to think more in like the 1 to 2 year time frame versus like a 10-year time frame, which I think is what most boomers tend to operate on. So I think it's kind of like, oh, we just have to get through this, we just have to keep on going. So I think it's like those three things potentially. Yeah,
I mean clearly the way that the polls will go, I mean Wisconsin or Arizona or Pennsylvania wouldn't have flipped if more younger people had voted. But nonetheless, I'm sure that maybe other red states where if the younger generation had voted, maybe like Kentucky, maybe West Virginia, that could have flipped over if you took the voting percent. I guess it doesn't matter. I'm going off topic here. This, I don't believe that people should be allowed to complain if they're not going to vote, as a matter of principle, because that's how you go and change things. And it's relatively easy to do, even if you're dead in Chicago.
Yeah, I'm sorry, just to interject, because I wanted to hit on this, right? So when you think about that dynamic of voting, I mean, one of the things that strikes me as really surprising is the cynicism that the younger generation has relative to even my own generation, right? So Gen X was, you know, we were supposed to be the cynics. We were the ones that were supposed to say, you know, none of it matters. You can't do anything. You can't accomplish it. Now, it turned out we were largely right. We were heavily ineffectual. And in a lot of ways, we have not had the opportunity. If Gavin Newsom is the best we can put out, that's a little disappointing. But when you think about that cynicism, it's certainly something that I encounter when I interact with the crypto universe, right? I mean, people react to me saying vote better, and their response is, oh, of course, you know, well, you're a statist and you're sucking at the teat of, you know, the traditional financial system. Of course, that's your conclusion. But it's surprising to me that there is that level of cynicism. Where do you think that's coming from? Because in all seriousness, like there are problems, but relative to many of the things that I experienced growing up, ranging from, you know, everything from much worse crime. Harley brought this up in an earlier conversation, right? I mean, New York City has devolved into a disaster zone until you compare it to the Dinkins administration, right? Or the late 1980s and early 1990s. What's driving the cynicism in your analysis?
Yeah, so Sri, I'll talk for a second and then you can weigh in. I think it's social media. So we see it all. We see everything, and that, like, and you know, you can't escape it. Like, all the time your phone is notifying you, like, oh, you know, we fell in Afghanistan, like Russia is doing a weird thing again too. And so it's just like constant bad news across like every domain that you're on, and it's super hard to escape. So I think that there's sort of this like, and even like the candidates that, you know, you have, it's like, well, I don't really like that person, but it's really hard to, as a youth, to run for office. Like, one of my best friends helps people who want to be political candidates and who are younger, like trying to get into office. But oftentimes the older generation who are like the incumbents in the office make it very, very hard for anything to change, even if they do get into office. So it's kind of like this like feedback loop, right? Like, so you hear things that are bad, you get a little sad. And then if you try to like go and enact change, there's all these barriers to entry that still exist within the political system. And that can just be really disheartening. So I think it's that kind of like that depressive cycle almost.
Interesting. And if I look at your TikTok videos, for the most part, like there's a touch of cynicism to them, right? I mean, it's definitely comedic, but I would argue that Brian undersold you, right? You've built an incredible franchise doing something that candidly is not that hard in concept, making fun of the traditional financial system and the people that, you know, go out and make various statements, myself included and others, right? But you do it remarkably well. Are you tapping into that cynicism, or are you more actually focused on, when you're doing it, are you thinking about the education, or are you thinking about the humor? I know you're thinking about both, but like what's the driving force for you, and what do you think people respond to most?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is like, I think I would say I'm probably a cynic with regards to the system. I just don't think it's like the frameworks in place just don't make sense. Like not like the Coinbase case, like that's a whole different thing that SEC needs to sort out. But like, you know, court case from 1946, like it just like it's sort of that stuff where like there's all these like mandates that are very, very old. But when I make my TikToks, like most of the time it's just like, how can I explain this in a way that's accessible to people? And usually that's through the lens of humor. And my type of humor is just like sort of making fun of things. So that it's never intentional. Like, I do respect the Fed. I do respect the SEC. But I think that, you know, in order to sort of enact change at that very local level, right? So to help people understand, to get people on board with like the system in general, you have to make fun of it almost, and you have to point fingers, and then they'll be like, oh, like this is something that's like pretty accessible to me. She's making fun of it. It might make sense for me to like do more research about it. So it's kind of like more of an onboarding tool at that point for people, I would say.
Sri, what's your reaction? I mean, you are, as you pointed out, you're a, you know, a boomer in a zoomer's body, right? Do you think the cynicism is misplaced, or do you think that there's a legitimate need to make some truly dramatic changes that are unlikely to change as long as the current power structure is there? I mean, what's your reaction to kind of what Kyla is leaning towards?
So I would argue So number one, at least from sort of say a voting or a political standpoint, what I've noticed is at least most of my friends tend to be pretty politically active. So especially on Instagram or you know, Twitter or something like that, you know, they tend to, you know, they tend to be very left-leaning, at least from what I've seen. But you know, leaving politics aside, where I say the cynicism comes from is, number one, it's partly humorous. So, you know, if you dunk on someone, you know, it gets a few laughs. But, you know, the other thing is, I think that on Twitter, it's easier to be cynical, especially when you're anonymous. So, you know, because number one, no one's going to know who you are. And number two, you know, no one's, you know, it doesn't really mean much. It doesn't really mean much, you know, outside Twitter. So I think that's sort of where, you know, cynicism in general comes from. And at least for my generation, I would agree with what Kyla said. So there's sort of some amount of distrust in the political establishment, at least the way things are run right now. And I personally think there should be some amount of change done to fix it. But I think the changes that are being proposed by at least members of my generation, at least I personally tend to disagree with them. So for example, giving 16-year-olds the vote is, at least in my opinion, not a very good idea. I personally disagree with most of the policies that, you know, they support. But I think that, you know, in order to say, you know, bring down housing prices, you know, you need to allow supply to rise. And it's just, I think it's just really hard to, I guess, convince people that, you know, the issue is that, you know, government is sort of implementing these zoning laws that reduce the supply of housing, or like, you know, post 2008, you know, home builders have sort of had PTSD in terms of building houses, and they've sort of built fewer houses versus, say, you know, someone becoming an Austrian economist and blaming the Fed, or, you know, someone becoming sort of a left winger and then just blaming the capitalists or the landlords and saying that, you know, it's just them becoming richer. But I might just be rambling on here, but that's sort of my take on it.
You actually bring up a really interesting point, Harley. I'm sorry. You brought up this issue of humor, and we've talked broadly around this humor versus cynicism or nihilism, right? How much is the older generation just misinterpreting the cynicism and nihilism? I mean, when I interact with Kyla or I interact with Shree in an honest off social media framework, I don't detect that you guys are not hopeful or that you are, you know, so dissatisfied that it's borderline dysfunctional. That could just be who I'm interacting with, but I'm wondering how much of the perception is just misinterpreting.
Maybe to an extent, but so
are you saying that the boomers are misinterpreting the zoomers?
Yes. Are we treating your humor as nihilism?
Maybe to an extent, yeah. But I mean, there's sort of a difference between zoomer humor and boomer humor.
Yeah.
Because I personally don't know. Like, I guess zoomers are sort of more exposed to, I guess, you know, general memes. So, you know, memes just making fun of all sorts of things and bringing that on Twitter versus, you know, boomer actually not getting them because they're not as familiar with them. So I think that might be part of it. And to an extent, you know, it's funny to, you know, let's say you write a post and says, you know, look, Bitcoin is bad. And you know, this is another reason why it's bad. And, you know, it's funny when they comment like, okay, boomer or something like that. So,
yeah. Yeah, that definitely has been part of my experience. Harley, I'm sorry, I cut you off. You were going to say.
I'm just wondering if this, calling it, you know, cynical snarkiness is really a quasi-symptom of despair. And I say this in the sense of, you see the advance of a Bernie Sanders or AOC, not personally, but this idea of quasi-socialism. And I wonder if what's really going on over here is because of the elevated housing prices, because of the cost of the massive debt to go to college, and everything else associated with this, is if all of a sudden our politics, and of course, you know, government support going to the elderly as opposed to the young, that maybe it's just a matter of if my upside potential has been clipped by government and demographic policy, at the very least, then maybe I should go build a floor underneath me. And that's what's really going on. I think that's really what's being said here with this snarkiness. And frankly, you know, if I didn't think I had the upside, I might as well have a floor on the downside. And that's not wrong. So it really goes back to this question of optimism for the future about, you know, about our whole society right now.
I mean, so, you know,
I do think that we're over allocating resources to the old. And I think the elderly, me included, I suppose, you know, maintain this, you know, grab of assets by voting more.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I'm going to redirect it to a couple of investment questions. So we talked about how you guys invest. Kyla, you mentioned that you engage in covered call strategies. Do either of you worry about a drawdown in the markets? Like, do you hedge in any way, shape, or form?
No.
That's what my waste stocks are for. They're supposed to be the hedge. Probably.
Like, that's why they're called diamond hands.
Yeah, no, I know. So that's actually, to me, this is one of the most fascinating things. And it's, you know, Harley, this is what you and I talk about all the time. It's just that all the products that are built, by far the most successful products at Simplify, are the ones that offer downside protection, right? The idea that it is a need to protect an underlying asset base because of a limited earning capacity or income capacity to add to that is far and away the most in-demand products. And I think there's this fascinating dynamic of we build products for people that have money, not for people who are going to have money, right? And if you guys were to think about what you would want to invest in, right? What would the answer be? I mean, Kyla, I know you're thrilled about your target date fund, but if you could make a choice, right? What would that product look like? Would it be levered so that it has more volatility to it? Would it be would it have a crypto bent to it? Would it, you know, so it's ESG or new economy or however you want to think about it?
Yeah.
Show me a picture.
There was a comment, I don't know if it was in the Q&A or in the chat, but somebody was like, do Gen Z do thematic investing? And I think that's a big thing. So like investing in companies that you do care about, like obviously, like, you know, there's some companies that you think are going to go up and you're investing in them. But I think like this generation, for as much as like nihilism may exist, there's also an underlying desire to change the world, right? So I think that's like really big. It's just like, how do you put your money sort of where your passions are? And I think that's what crypto does well to a certain extent, or what it's meant to do or designed to do. And I think like ESG is like a whole different story. Like that's always a little bit poorly structured in my opinion. But I think like if you can invest in products that you think are going to like really have an impact on society, that's the best place that you can be. Yeah.
So when you think about that type of dynamic, because we've had a number of headlines that have come out in the past couple of weeks that are hitting on ESG in the way that you're saying it, right? It's kind of fake. There's no real, you know, control systems, et cetera. Does that impact the ESG, you know, the cynicism effectively around ESG? Does it change an allocation mechanism, or do people kind of accept, well, it's the best we can do right now?
I mean, I think everybody knows it's sort of just like putting a tutu on a pig and, you know, calling it something pretty. But I think like still people invest in it, obviously, like it's still a very in-demand product. But sorry, if you can hear the motorcycle.
That's all right.
Somebody's just racing up the street. But I think that like, you know, when you think about ARK, like those sorts of products are really appealing to my generation because it's like innovative, right? So it's like, oh, Kathy Woods, for whatever you think about like how she does what she does, and she's a whale in a lot of small biotechs, she's still like thinking actively about like the future of investing. So like whether that be space, whether that be her fintech fund. So I think it's like more of that kind of stuff, like ESG, climate change, that needs to manifest in a different way before it's appealing.
Interesting. Sri, from your perspective, what would coax you out of managing your own stock, you know, your own portfolio and picking stocks to an investor portfolio, right? A diversified fund portfolio, even just for diversification purposes.
Yeah, I think, you know, what Simplify is doing is awesome, especially on that path. So that's one thing. The other thing is I personally enjoy picking stocks. It's sort of an intellectual exercise, or it's almost like a game for me, you know, sitting down, spending all day reading and then trying to win a game and play better than other people. So you
think about it as a game, on effectively a board game that you're playing, that you're, you know, gaining skills relative to the rest. It's less about the money at this point.
To an extent, yeah. Well, some of it is definitely for the money. And I guess ever since, you know, I was a kid, I've always been into sort of these type of things. So I've played a lot of chess, and trying to, in general, intellectual exercises have pretty much been my thing, or something that I like to do. And that's part of why I like to pick stocks. But I think that in terms of shifting to entirely say portfolio that consists of ETFs, I think Simplify is sort of solving that problem there, because number one, you're able to do better than the market to an extent, and you're also sort of able to hedge the downside exposure and so on. And the question that you asked at the start was if other of us actually worry about markets going down, and the answer is yes. And from say an ESG standpoint, personally, I'm sort of an ESG cynic. I think Harris Kupperman's stake that ESG stands for energy stops growing is humorous, and it's to an extent right as well. But I'm personally not a fan of ESG, but I noticed that most of my friends are. And that's another thing that the Zoomer generation is looking for to invest in. What are morally good companies, however you define it, and something that's actually doing good for the world, as opposed to say, an ExxonMobil, which drills oil and leads to climate changes and so on. And
one of the things that popped up in an industry report that I read the other day that surprised me, and I'd love to hear your reaction to this, which is that the younger generation is actually extremely interested in human interaction for advice. In other words, the RIA community, the registered investment advisor community, if they paid attention to the younger generation is interested in help in managing their investments. Kyla, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I wrote about this a tiny little bit, that the advisor generation is simply not prepared, or the advisors are not prepared for the Gen Z generation. I think that there is the desire to talk to people, but not on the phone, and maybe not even in person, maybe through chat, maybe through your Discord server. So I think there is that desire to have people guide you along the path. But the way that advisors do it now, and even the way that they structure the portfolios, that's just not going to fly. It's going to be a lot more individualized, I think. People are really, they're not going to be okay, 60-40, cool, let's go. It's going to be more so I want to be in this company. I want to do this sort of investing. And also I need to have room for my crypto allocation. Can you help me with that? And I think it's going to be more in a text-based environment versus the way that it is now.
That's a fascinating idea, actually, a Discord-based RIA advisory service. I mean, it explains so much, because I go on to either Twitter spaces, or I go onto a Discord channel where people are talking about crypto. And I do actually actively try to seek out this information. It's astonishing to me how little validation, the blue check mark on Twitter is a joke because nobody cares about it, right? The fact that you're a blue check mark is actually almost a negative badge to the younger generation, right? But I see stuff, being shared in these channels, and I'm horrified. I'm like, oh my God, that's not true, right? And how do you guys think about managing the quality of the information that you receive?
That's another tough one. There's somebody wrote a piece about curators versus creators, and we have so much information out there right now that you almost have to have a designated curator, sort of simplifying everything down for you. So I think that's going to be an increasing role. We always talk about the creator economy, but I think that there's going to be this curator economy too, where you have people who are organizing stuff, fact checking things, because there's so much disinformation, misinformation, especially on TikTok, where people are buy this coin, it'll go up 100,000%. So there is going to be more services that are actually gut checking and organizing information. And but for right now, it's just you have to do signal versus noise, which is always hard.
So when you think about that message, right? I mean, that's actually a really, I see an ad that says this coin's going to go up 100,000%, right? Or 1,000% or whatever. And my immediate, BS detector goes off and says, that guy's a scammer or that girl's a scammer, right? what is your generation? How does your generation react to that? Or why put that content out there, right? That is so obviously promotional. Is it effective?
To an extent, yeah. So at least on Instagram, there's an account called Baller Busters, which does exactly that. So it takes, you know, these fake traders or these fake, you know, gurus and sort of exposes them. So in a way, I think partly number one is you see at least over the last few years, you've seen the rise of what I would call, say, like the coaching economy or the course selling economy. You know, everyone's selling these courses on, you know, forex trading or whatever it is. I guess to an extent, number one, it's been very profitable, at least for the scammers and the gurus who do it. But on the other hand, you know, it is definitely difficult to sort of navigate your way around number one, someone who has something to sell to you versus, you know, someone who's actually putting out good, genuine information. And in a way, you know, everyone has something to sell, but, you know, someone who has like ulterior motives with their content versus someone who's actually putting out content to help people, it is definitely very difficult to sort of, I guess, sift through those kind of posts or those kind of accounts.
I think that's actually probably a pretty good place for us to wrap up. We got Brian coming in to give us the rug pull, to use the crypto term. I really appreciate you guys coming on and speaking so honestly about, you know, the way that you see the financial world, the dynamics around investment. The thing that I'm taking away from this most is that there is, you know, I would basically say that Kyla paid for everyone's hour long attendance with the observation about the curator economy versus the creator economy. It's a fascinating idea. I really, really love that way of thinking about it. I'm going to try to go away and think a little bit about how we can help in that framework, but it's a really interesting idea. Brian, I'm going to hand it over to you.
So actually I wanted to kind of try and end on a positive note, and a number of the questions that we were getting kind of were really focused on the cynicism of, you know, the kind of the intergenerational conflict. And Mike, I thought you've done a couple different podcasts where you really focused on reasons to be optimistic in the future. So love to kind of hear from each of you, you know, what can change? What are you optimistic about changing that kind of, you know, maybe puts a period on the cynicism and creates a little bit of optimism for Gen Z and millennials?
Maybe rephrase that just a little bit, like Kyla and Sri, what would make you guys really optimistic, right? What would break the cynicism? What would you want to see?
That's a good question.
I mean, I think it'd be cool to see a little bit of a shakeup in our politician makeup, like who's running the country would be like, maybe make them like a little, not 85. That'd be cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then maybe is it something around, you know, the rise of crypto and kind of these disruptive technologies and maybe that enabling, you know, your generation and the millennials to have a little bit more of a say in financial markets and the way that this, the whole system is structured?
Yeah, agreed.
You know, the thing that I would point out, and I would just highlight this is, you know, that actually is really encouraging to me. And I know people are sick of hearing my enthusiasm and excitement, but this generation of political leaders is almost gone, right? I mean, there is only so much ossification that can actually happen. So you are going to get it. The question is, what do you do with it when you get it? And that's going to be, that we're going to have to leave for another day. But I again, just wanted to say thank you so much. This was really a privilege. I thank you to everyone who joined, and I can't get this curator economy thought out of my mind.
All right, awesome. Well, Sri, Kyla, thank you so much. Harley, Mike, thank you. So next month, in honor of Cancer Awareness Month, we're going to have a really interesting conversation on healthcare investing with hedge fund investor Mike Taylor and Susan G. Komen Foundation. So tune in for that. We'll send a follow-up with the replay to this. But thank you, everyone, for joining us. Have a great afternoon, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe and we'll see you next time.